No entity on 212. Comm check.
DPS. Go. Inco. Go. PUS. Go. Surgeon.
Go.
Booster.
Go.
Copy that. We have a go from you guys.
This is Talking Sound.
Well, hello, everybody, and welcome to the Talking Sound Podcast, the only podcast on the internet where negative 10 is a number to be desired. I am Chris Jordan, your host, and with me right now is Chris Reddish. I met Chris many years ago. I guess we've been working together probably a good 5 to 7 years now on numerous shows in the Houston area. He is a translator by day and does translation for corporate events, stuff like that, but is also a comedian, improv comedian, writer, director, all kinds of stuff. And we're going to talk about the whole panoply that is his life and kind of what led him into this industry on both sides, both as technician and performer. So welcome to the show, Chris.
Well, thank you, Chris. Thank you very much. And I'm going to have to go and Google panoply, find out what it is that I'm supposed to be talking about. Yeah.
It almost means a plethora. Oh. It's just a wide array.
Plethora I am familiar with.
Okay. Yeah. Yeah.
Cool. Thank you. Thank you very much for having me. I really appreciate it.
You are a menagerie of a man and a dodecahedron of a person. You know, just I'm going to see how verbose I can get here. There are many facets to Chris Reddish. And that's what's interesting is that, like I said, when I first met you, it was on a corporate gig that I've worked for nine years now in Houston. Right. I want to say we both worked it for the same amount of time. And you're typically there with the translation booths. If I'm not mistaken, you're a Russian translator. Am I correct?
No, you are incorrect.
I am
translation technician when I'm on those jobs. So I'm just making sure that everybody can hear the translators.
Gotcha. So you're me. I thought you were actually like one of the people in the booth here and there. So
I only go in the booth to sound test or take a nap.
Okay. Well, I've definitely taken a nap in the booths before. They're very well insulated. But what led you into audio engineering to begin with? Let's start there. Since that is career path, and then we'll follow that up with a passion path and what got you into comedy.
Okay. All right, cool. Okay. So I'm not really an audio technician. I don't have that training or qualifications that you and your colleagues have. I basically am a translation audio person. So I understand and know enough to operate translation equipment, but I couldn't do what you guys do. So basically what happened was that 25 years or so ago, a group that I was involved with, nonprofit group, had some really old translation equipment and they didn't want it anymore. And I arranged to buy it from them. And it was horrible. It was an AM inductive loop system.
Love it.
That required an antenna to be taped to the floor and had a range of about 10 feet. So you had to zigzag this cable that you taped to the floor, you know, every 10, 20 feet in between the chairs. It was just a horrible, horrible system. But for a couple of years, we used that and we managed to save up enough money to buy a small FM system. And then we built up from there.
That's one of the things that I wanted to talk to you about. And one of the reasons why I wanted to have you on the show is because it is a lot of this show is different paths within the industry, things that people don't understand. Like, oh, you know, like I started off in rock and roll and theater, really in theater, and then moved into rock and roll after college, stuff like that. And buddy, the day I found the world of corporate AV, I ran with arms wide open. When I moved to Austin, people were like, "Oh, what's the rock scene like?" I'm like, "I don't know, man. I don't touch it. I do nothing but corporate AV now.
Right.
And it's not for everybody. It's a different world than rock and roll. It's a different world than theater. And it's interesting how even though the job is basically the same amongst the industries, the industry itself is so different. Mm-hmm. What was it like for you as an entrepreneur, as somebody starting out, striking out with their own business and doing that kind of stuff? Explain some of that to our audience, because like I definitely appreciate that, owning my own business, owning my own podcast network, things like that. But not everybody understands some of the intricacies involved. And the one thing that I loved that you mentioned, because everybody always asks me how I ended up with all this gear. It was like, well, I had a day job for a long time and I did gigs at night, and all the money, the like daytime paid my bills, gigs at night bought my gear. And then it just, once I became self-employed and doing my stuff, it became the fact that I tried to make a, like earmark a certain amount of money from every gig to put toward more gear, you know, and the fact that you started, like you said, with an inductive loop AM system, something that nowadays you would absolutely have to have a FCC regulated license or permit to use. you know, like there's like they would come find you rapidly. they would triangulate your position so fast, come and say, why are you doing this? Please show us your permit to own this. To go from one to the other, what was it like for you, to entrepreneurially take that on?
It was tough, basically. So I moved to this country in 1992. My wife won a green card in the lottery.
Wow.
That's the lottery that President Trump has made a big deal of trying to abolish. I am one of the people that benefited from that. So anyway, so in 1992, we came to this country, and after trying to work in McDonald's for a couple of weeks and then trying to drive airport buses for a few weeks, I ended up learning how to clean people's houses. And so for 4 years, I had a business cleaning people's houses, and I hated every minute of it. Mm-hmm. But after about 3 years, I put an ad, I wanted to use this translation equipment. I put an ad in the Yellow Pages, and I carried a pager. And at the end of a cleaning job, I would return people's calls and take on translation jobs. And after about a year of that, I was able to stay at home and manage both businesses from home. And after another year of that, I was able to sell off the cleaning business and concentrate full time on the translation business. So it was like a 2 or 3 year changeover period. But you know, it was tough. It was tough having to do a job that I hated whilst trying to set up a new business that I would like. And even once we got into, you know, once it was full-time translation, it was hard work. I most of the jobs myself, I was technologist, but all the jobs, plus I was trying to manage the business as well. Plus the system that we used was horrible. And I built a website, and I built it myself using a dial-up internet connection. life was hard at times, you know, but it paid off. I mean, it was a lot of hard work, but after a few years of really intense work, it reached a point where it kind of reached cruising altitude and began to be that, so that I could start to hire people to do a lot of the work, so that I didn't have to do it all myself. And you know, I could back off a little bit and, you know, go from overworking night, day and weekends to, you know, cutting back to just daytimes. And yeah, so it paid off, but it took a while.
Well, and that's just it. You really, whenever it's something that I've tried to instill in the episodes of this show and tried to show with my guests is the fact that don't give up, folks. It ain't easy being cheesy. That's the only way I can put it. And it takes a lot of work. And more than anything, it takes a lot of wherewithal. Because, yeah, you know, it takes years. I've been in the Austin market for 7 years now, and it's just now gotten to the point where people call me regularly. You know, it takes a while whenever you hit a new market, whenever you're doing something new, A, to find your stride, B, to find your best way of doing that market and taking care of and servicing your clients. But it also takes some time to grow to that potential and get to the point, like you said, where instead of working 7 days a week, not taking a vacation, you can now work 5 days a week and focus some of your time on other things in life and actually have a life.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. exactly.
And that's what a lot of people don't understand is that, yeah, you may not have a life, folks, for a little while. Like when I remember when I started dating my wife, it took a while for that barrier of trust to build because I had a business, and a lot of people are like, you know, it's taken y'all a long time to move this thing along and get to marriage. I'm like, yeah, but you don't understand. I'm not just like dating someone. Like, I'm bringing somebody into the crazy world that is my self-employed life of owning a business. And they have to understand the ups and downs of that. They have to understand the dynamic of that. And, you know, I have to be able to trust somebody with my business, you know,
right.
In order to grow that relationship. And there are so many hurdles that it can seem impossible at times. But what were some of the issues that you faced other than technical issues that you faced when you first started with your business?
Other than the technical issues, I think just the whole marketing process, I mean, obviously it's totally different now. You know, 23 years ago, it was a very different world of marketing than it is now. That certainly took a lot of effort to get, you know, to get placed in the yellow pages, and each city had a different company that ran their yellow pages. You know, there was no, if you wanted to be in one of the yellow pages, you had to call a different company. There was no, yeah. I mean, it was ridiculous the way it was. And I think always finding the right people, I guess that would be the biggest thing. Finding the right people, finding people that care enough to do a good job, that like this kind of work, mm-hmm. Are willing to be flexible, and you know, and that they will do a good job if I treat them well. Find, you know, but I think finding the right people has to be the biggest.
And I couldn't agree with that more. Having put people out there with my name on their shirt,
right.
You know, it's one of those you really do. It's hard because it's like having somebody babysit your kid.
Mm-hmm.
You know,
it is
like you're trusting somebody with your livelihood here. You know, like you could lose an entire client base because somebody had a bad day. If you don't choose the right people to work with, and with that in mind, choosing the right people to work with, I want to kind of seg into how you came involved with comedy, because that's really one of those things that is a passion for people, you know, mm-hmm. and it's another one of those things that chemically you have to be with the right people There are people who, when they enter a troupe, can, even though they're great and fantastic, can be toxic to the chemistry of a group, you know, and it's really delicate. My wife teaches improv comedy and is a comedian herself, stuff like that. But how did you first get involved with comedy?
Yeah, so as a kid, I always loved comedy and wanted to do performance, but I was too shy. And so I never auditioned for the school play or did any of that kind of stuff. And then in my mid-20s, I was traveling and I was in Africa with a whole group of people. And I think I was just so far away from home that I didn't care anymore. And so we decided to put on a comedy show out in in Port Sudan. We got good reviews, you know, people liked it. So we did another one. And then when I got back from traveling, I did occasional sketch comedy for a few years. And then when I was living back in England. And then when I moved here, I just went along to an improv show and talked to the director and ended up signing up for the classes and yeah, never looked back. Basically, I spent 5 years with that troupe, and the teacher was absolutely brilliant. He really taught me everything I know about comedy. He was a comic genius. And then he died in the year 2000, and I continued on with the troupe. The troupe continued under a different name for a few years. I continued with them for a while. And then moved into the film side of things a little bit more.
Great. And speaking of that, you did actually just finally release a film that you've been working on for a while, 1111, comedy sci-fi. You're the writer and director. It just premiered at the Hollywood Boulevard Film Fest to great acclaim, winning Best Comedic Feature, Best Director, Best Actor, and Best Actress. Like, basically a sweep of awards for, like, you know, first time at the plate, and here's a grand slam. Hey, how's that feel?
Well, that felt pretty good, I have to admit. I was really nervous because this was our first showing to any audience, and I was really nervous about it. And,
oh, yeah.
I was very pleased that we got a lot of laughs, and they were mostly in the places where I wanted them to be. Okay. So I was very pleased with that. And then, the next evening there was an award ceremony, and it really was amazing that, we really did get recognized. So that was fantastic.
Well, and tell us a little bit about the writing process of that. Because I'm someone, I give my wife sketch ideas all the time. She teaches a lot of sketch and produces a monthly sketch show, and I can't write a lick outside of like, you want me to write a monologue all day long, I can write you a good monologue, but I cannot write within the voice of another person. And for her, it's literally the fact that she's like, I think you're looking at it wrong, these people are just in my head. You know, like, they're already talking to me. I'm just writing it down. How does that process as a writer, as a creator, work for you? How do you find the words coming to life? How do you find the characters coming to life?
I do agree with your wife that it takes me a while to get to that point, but there is a point where, yes, the characters have a voice. They have a personality. I see them in my head. I hear them in my head, and so I just imagine them in that situation. What are they going to say? What are they going to do? I would agree with that. But there's a whole process for me to get to that point, and the first part of this process. And I learned this from a screenwriting teacher, the LA Writers Lab. I love their process. And so this is how I learned this process that I now use. It's a very free form stream of consciousness, I would call it, writing, where you ask yourself a question and then you just write, blurt out whatever comes out. You write it down. Okay. And you know, in that paragraph or page or whatever it is you've written, there might be one or two little gems that stand out and get transferred forward, or there may be none, you know, or it might be the whole thing gets transferred verbatim into your screenplay later, but you don't know that at the time. You never know what's going to come out, but through this process, you generate a ton of material, and then you sift through that material to see what do I think fits, what fits in terms of ideas and plots, what seems to fit what I want to work on, but mainly in terms of character. What fits in terms of character? Is this person, you know, what's he hiding? What's his secret? What does he want? What does he fear? You know, these kind of thoughts start to come out and coalesce and start to become part of the bigger story.
All right. And now, myself as it, just for example, a reader and watcher of comic book movies, let's say, my wife, teaches a principle that once the character is written, like, you need to stay within the world of that character. You can't really, like, break his rules, you know?
Right.
Kind of like, for me, I had an issue with the re-release of Superman years ago, the one that came out where Superman was mysteriously going to check out Krypton, his planet that had been dead for who knows how long, you know, and he left pregnant Lois on Earth. He'd have never left pregnant Lois. Like, that is an utter betrayal of the character of Superman. Are you a writer? Are you someone that stays within that paradigm whenever you write someone that they have to obey the rules of the character per se? Or are you a bit more fluid with the creation of things?
Well, I would suggest that under the right circumstances, anyone will do almost anything.
Okay.
And so I would argue that if Superman is going to leave pregnant Lois, what is the circumstance that would cause him to do something that is so out of character for him? There must be something. I don't know what it is. I'm not in that world, but you know, but there is a something. And if they didn't put that something in the movie, then I think they let their audience down.
Yeah. It was definitely one of those, like, what? He went to go check out, like, blown up Krypton? He already knows it's blown up. What's he going to check out?
Yeah.
So that was one of those, like, okay, I guess I'll let that one slide. Let's get into a little bit of the movie itself, 1111. Give us a little primer of what – some broad strokes of what it's about, the plot, and the creative process of that movie itself.
Okay. All right. So it's the story of a man who accidentally slept with an alien 16 years ago and never mentioned the fact to his wife. And also, a baby came about as a result of that mishap, and it's a half human, half alien hybrid child that he manages to persuade his wife to grow up, to raise as their own daughter. But he doesn't mention to his wife that this, the origins of this daughter, that it's actually his daughter. He passes her off as a baby found in the woods. And they raise this daughter together, and he hasn't told his wife anything about how the baby came about, and he also hasn't told the daughter about who she really is. And then the hot alien returns and wants to get to know her daughter and wants to spend time with the guy. And of course, that starts to cause some problems. And yeah. So the truth starts to come out and chaos starts to ensue.
Yeah.
And, yeah.
And as that it, sounds as it does. Yeah, yeah, as it tends to do in such situations.
Yes.
And now, how did that idea come to birth for you? How did that, like, because that is an intricate web to be woven to begin with, and an even more intricate web to reveal to an audience. What was your process for that?
Yeah, so I think the idea of that, it just came out of the thought of, well, you know, we or maybe I have white lies. You know, sometimes there are things that I just really don't want to tell other people. And so if I'm going to keep something secret, then what are the implications of that? And what happens when I get found out? And, you know, let's take that on a bigger scale. Let's. You know, up this to, you know, to a major, I mean, you couldn't even call it a white lie, a major secret. What are the consequences there? And I had decided when I first started working on it, I decided I wanted to write about alien or UFO enthusiasts, alien enthusiasts—a group of people that are into aliens. I decided I wanted to. That was going to be my focus, and then this is the story that evolved. And again, it was through that process of stream of consciousness writing that these ideas started to develop and come out. And the whole process of writing ended up taking about 18 months, although the last 6 months were also pre-production. We were ready to make the film for the last 6 months, although there were still some tweaks going on to the script. So basically it was about 18 months of writing.
Okay. Yeah, and I mean, that's it. From what I know, that's about typical for most people who have written and edited and re-edited for something like that to come about. And I have a good friend who's been on the show before as well, John Seymour, who does more horror thriller type things, stuff like that. But even talking to him about the creative process once you're on set and once things start going, was it the fact that once production started flowing, that you found the script morphed any? Did changes come about as readings went on with the actors, you know, as things went on with the camera? Did you have any, let's say, improv moments that came about and were birthed that were kept within the story and the crux of the plot?
All of that really applies. So part of the process of pre-production, that in fact I think probably my favorite part of it is a process, and again I learned this from somebody, a guy called Mark Travis, who is a fantastic teacher of acting and directing, and he teaches a process called creative staging, which some people would call blocking, you know, deciding where the actor's going to be, where the camera's going to be. But a lot of and a lot of people approach that from a very technical point of view of, okay, we're going to have the best light if the actor stands there, and then we need to have him move over there so that the camera can capture his face in this angle. Yeah. So a lot of people approach it technically, but he approaches it from a purely artistic point of view. His idea is what actions will enhance the subtext of the scene, and then the camera's job is to find a way of picking that up. Okay. So you never cater to the camera. The camera's job is to pick that up. So we went through a long process of going through scene by scene with actor friends of mine, and finding the nuances of subtext in the scene. And so the script changed quite a lot through that process. And that went on for 6 to 9 months, something like
that. Oh, wow.
Yeah, and that's, I mean, obviously not full time, but just doing occasional rehearsals, yeah, for quite a long period. So then when we got to set, we had a pretty clear idea of how each scene was supposed to go. But yes, we were really fortunate with, you know, both of the main actors and even some of the characters that were not the main actors, but they were great improvisers. They both have a lot of experience in improv. And so, yes, they were coming up with new stuff all the time on set. And we were able to leave quite a lot of that in. And to me, that a lot of it, what they produced on set is the funniest moments.
Oh, sure.
I just love some of the lines that they came up with and the ideas that they came up with, I think, are the funniest parts. So,
well,
yes,
a lot of a lot of people don't realize that, especially once you get, like we were saying earlier, the right chemistry going on, the right mix of people. Prime examples of things like that happening. I mean, go back and watch movies like Caddyshack. Watch movies like Ghostbusters, where some of those prime, beautiful moments that we quote all the time were utterly improvised. In front of the camera, they were not scripted. I don't even think that they gave Bill Murray a script for Caddyshack, if I'm not mistaken. they just like said, "Yep, he's there," and they just kind of let him go.
Right.
And things like that, those kind of experiments for me as a musician, that's a lot of how I make my music, is just kind of going in and letting the muse take control and letting the moment happen, and accepting things as they happen without kind of self-editing a whole lot. Do you find yourself a large self-editor whenever you're going through these processes?
A self-editor. I guess I would say I am a self-editor because I make a lot of changes. Hopefully not so much once we get on set, but certainly during the writing process, I do make a lot of changes and I reread the script and make a bunch of notes and then make a bunch of changes. And I also send it to friends and they make notes and then I make changes. I would say I think that would make me a self-editor, I guess.
And now you were saying before the show that the most tedious part of things and the most heart-wrenching part of things for you was the post-production process. It is a world of tedium, to say the least. I've edited music for people before, and there is a reason I don't work in studios. I could not sit and edit like that all day. It is a world of tedium to live in. Now, what was that process like for you as someone going through it for their first time with their creation, with your baby? What was it like, A, to go through the process, B, to experience it with your creation and see your creation begin to take shape and come to life?
Well, it was a really difficult process. I mean, the reality is, you know, we had a fixed limited budget and we spent too much of it on production. And we did not save enough for post-production. You know, the flip side of that is we got two great actors. We got Charles Baker, who played Skinny Pete on Breaking Bad, and we got Krista Allen, who had her sitcom Significant Mother. She was in Baywatch. So, you know, so we had two great lead actors plus a number of other supporting actors that I was absolutely thrilled that we had. Plus, you know, I in retrospect, perhaps it wasn't all that wise to write a low budget independent feature that is set one third on board a spaceship. I did come to regret that decision during the post-production process. anyway, it was what it was. So because we had limited budget, and I didn't even know this role existed, but we should have had a post-production supervisor, somebody that understands the whole overview of post-production and managed the process and coordinated all of the different crew that were doing the various different aspects of post-production.
Sure.
We didn't have that person. By default, I ended up doing it, and I never should have done it. A, because I don't know how, and B, because I was trying to do a million other things as well. You know, keeping a business running, having enough, money for the family, staying involved with the family, you know, all of those kind of things. And my capacity was very limited. I really only handle one person at a time, and it didn't have to be that way. We could have had multiple people working alongside or in parallel with each other on different parts of the process, but I couldn't manage that. And so I was just dealing with one person at a time. That's one reason why things took so long.
Sure.
I think it's probably one of the most traumatic experiences of my life is I got together a bunch of friends fairly early on. It's, I don't know, maybe 6 months after we shot, something like that. And I showed them the rough cut of the movie with no effects other than me, you know, sticking in a photo of a UFO where there was supposed to be a UFO and, you know, and
Plan 9 version.
Even worse than that, but
I want to see
and
that
I showed version. And all the no you do not and all the green screen stuff was still just a green screen and I showed it to people and asked their feedback, and the feedback I got was horrible. I mean, that, you know, basically everybody hated it. At that point, I was at least 2 years into the process, and we'd shot, and really wasn't a lot we could do about it. And it really, really did set me back emotionally.
Yeah,
it took me a long time to recover from that. And I will, I've learned I will not do that again next time. If there is a next time for me, I will not be showing something that rough to anyone.
That goes to speak to something, because I frequently don't even show my music to my wife until it's finished. You know, mm-hmm. I don't really. There are a couple people that I trust that can hear what might go in the empty spots. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
That right. Can see that vision in the green screen. They can see the forest and the trees at the same time, and they can give me some honest feedback. But it's hard to show somebody something, A, that you've spent such a conglomerate amount of time on and such a passion project to begin with, and then to have that response. Yeah, it's hard because – not everybody has the imagination to see what's not there. And I think that really goes straight back to the concept of improv. You know, it's something that my wife has to tell people in her sketch troupe all the time for her show, The Neighborhood, is like, well, I don't have this. And she's like, but your character does. Like, you don't have to physically have it, you see. Mm. Do you have the imagination to act like you have that in your hand? You know, because if you have it, then you can put it forth, and most people will accept the fact that, oh, he's got that in his hand,
yes,
whether it's there or not. And, you know, something that I, especially being a comic book fan, am big on is writing. And whenever people are like, oh, that movie was horrible, and it's like, don't blame the actors, you know, like they can only act what's on the page. So the fact that, yes, you had mm-hmm. some great actors means that they were able to apply what was on the page and make it their own and really go somewhere with it. So kudos to you on that. Like, there's a reason why you won Best Comedy Feature, why you won Best Director, and why you – the Best Actor and Best Actress, you may as well have gotten Best Writing too, because it's only due to the writing that the actors can even pull anything off the page to work with. You know, there are movies where Tom Cruise is amazingly awesome, and there are movies where he just falls flat.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
You know, and yeah. it's utterly the writing of the movie and the way that things are plotted out and the way that characters are developed. If there's barely anything for an actor to work with for character development to begin with, then it's hard for them to tell a story and to emote a story to an audience. So kudos mm-hmm. to you on that.
Yeah.
Now comes the next tooth pulling part of the process, distribution. Yeah. How do you go about even tackling that?
Another gap in my knowledge. Yes. So we are looking for the right sales agent, and we are entering a bunch of festivals. And it's a bit of a, you know, chicken and egg situation of, is it best to get a sales agent who can help you get into the best film festivals, or do you go into the film festivals, which will help you get a better sales agent?
Sure.
Yes, and I don't know the answer to that. I don't know that there is a one correct answer, but that's basically what we're working on, is to get ourselves a sales agent and to learn as much as we can about the distribution process. I think to a certain extent these days, distribution ends up being partially self-distribution. No matter what you do, you've got to have your fan base, you've got to promote it, you've got to have people that want to watch it, even if you are going to sell it to somebody else who's then going to sell it to the customers. You've got to show them that people want to see this movie.
That's right.
So you have to do your own marketing as well. We're learning all of that stuff.
It's a growing process, isn't it?
Yes, it certainly is. Yes, I feel like I'm a different person than I was when I started this. And I also feel like I cannot believe.
Are you still there?
God, it pointed the process. I cannot believe. You lost me?
Yeah, sorry.
Can you hear me?
Yes, I'm here.
Okay, yeah, no. Okay, good. Sorry. Yeah, so I was saying I can't believe how ignorant I was at so many different stages of the production, that, you know, that things now that are obvious to me in retrospect, I had no idea of beforehand. And that has been the case all the way through. And I think it's going to be the case in this next element as well of getting the distribution process. But I would say, if anyone is interested, to please do look us up on Facebook and Twitter. The 1111 movie should come up on both Facebook and Twitter, and do like and subscribe, etc. We would love to have your support there. And also check out our trailer. We've got a great trailer. It's on YouTube.
Great.
If you type in 1111 1111 trailer on YouTube, it will come right up. Take a look at that. We'd love to have your support.
I will make sure to embed that trailer in the episode post for this so that it gets out to all of our listeners right there with the player for this episode. Everybody, it will be directly underneath that. So let's support these guys. Let's make sure they get out there and get the funding they need, that they get the attention they need. I would highly recommend, Chris, that you check out the Breach.tv platform. Okay. They are like YouTube, but they monetize a whole lot faster. Mm. And you get paid for views. It's great. That is one of the main distribution points of all of the podcasts on the HC Universal Network. It is a probably about a year and a half old platform with tens of thousands of users that are hungry for new content. So I guarantee you, if you put that up, man, you will start seeing some views rapidly.
Great. Okay. Thank you.
And if you can, once again, just tell everybody where they can go to check everything out for 11/11, the film. And if you can hold the line after that, I will chat with you off air.
Okay.
So, where can they go on Facebook? Where can they go on Twitter? Where should they go to find 11/11, the movie?
Okay. If you go to Facebook and just type in 11/11 movie, we will come up, and same is true on Twitter. On YouTube, 11/11 trailer will bring up, the trailer, if you can subscribe to us on any of those platforms, then you will find out our festival showings, which will tell you when we're going to be in your area.
Great. And where can anybody go to find out about translation services should they need them?
Our website for translation is abbn.com. That's a bridge between nations.com. abbn.com.
Fantastic. Chris, once again, thank you so much for spending the time with myself and our audience. You shared some great information with us today, and a great personal story of growth, of business, and of being a self-starter. That's what this show is all about, is showing people that there are numerous paths to life. There are numerous paths to following your passion in numerous different industries of production, whether it's film, whether it's audio, whether it's running translation booths. They are all part of the production of audio and video, either for film or live events. So thank you so much for coming on and sharing everything with our audience.
Well, thank you, Chris. I really appreciate it. It's been a lot of fun, and thank you for doing what you do, and thank you for inviting me.
Absolutely. And while you're checking his stuff out online, everybody, make sure to go to TalkingSoundShow.com. That is where you can find all of our episodes. That's also where you can find technical articles out the wazoo from major manufacturers like Rupert Neve, Shure Microphones. We also have instructional episodes there. There's also the Freelance AV Directory. If you are a freelancer like myself, there is a map of the United States. You click the region, it pulls up a list of states that have cities. You click the city, and there are companies that hire freelancers. So go check out the Freelance Index and make sure to check us out on our parent network, HCUniversalNetwork.com. Until next time, everybody, keep reaching for 11, and we'll talk to you soon. Take care.
This is Talking Sound.